So are there prophecies about the Messiah in the Torah? And can we really find Jesus legitimately in the five books of Moses?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, what is the foundation of Scripture for a Jewish person in particular? Not just the Hebrew Bible, but the Torah, the five books of Moses. Traditional Jews believe that they were dictated to Moses by God. The Torah, the five books of Moses, the Pentateuch. Does the Torah contain messianic prophecy? Does the Torah contain prophecy that indicates to us that Jesus, Yeshua, is the Messiah? Michael Brown, thanks so much for joining us today on The Line of Fire. It's Thursday, which means Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, which means we'll take your Jewish-related questions, and in particular, we'll focus on the Torah today. We'll focus on messianic prophecy in the Torah. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Online, askdrbrown.org. Click on The Line of Fire. Now, look, on a certain level, I understand you can find anything you want in the Bible if you read it in and try to project it, but then it will not stand the test because it's not truthful. We want to read out what's in the text. We want to look back and ask some questions. What's God seeking to teach us through the five books of Moses? And do the five books of Moses point to Jesus, Yeshua, as the Messiah of Israel? Now, after Yeshua's resurrection from the dead, it tells us in Luke's Gospel, chapter 24, a passage we've looked at a number of times here on the Line of Fire broadcast, that Jesus opened up the Scriptures to his disciples. And beginning with Moses and the prophets, the Psalms, referring to the threefold division of the Hebrew Bible. That's why Jews call it Tanakh. There are three different divisions in the traditional Jewish order: Torah, the first five books, Nevi'im, the books of the prophets, some of the major prophets, and some of the historical books, and then Ketuvim, everything else. And together that is called Tanakh. That's probably what Jesus was pointing to, that threefold division written in Moses and the prophets and the Psalms. He said, it's about me. It has to be fulfilled. First, the Messiah would have to suffer and die and rise. He said, it's not some new message I'm introducing. This is what's written here in the Torah. In Matthew 5, beginning verse 17, he says, don't think I came to abolish the Torah of the prophets. I didn't come to abolish, but to fulfill. And then in John, the fifth chapter, speaking to Jewish leaders, he says, look, you studied the Torah, you studied the five books of Moses, and he testifies about me. Moses, the five books testify about me. So if Jesus is to be taken seriously, then we will find him in the Torah, not in some hidden esoteric reference where we've got to manufacture it and read it in and only in the most obscure way, stand on your head and read this three times backwards. No, laid out plainly. So we want to talk about that today on The Line of Fire. Also, we're getting some amazing reports. I mean, amazing reports from readers of The Real Kosher Jesus. Some really encouraging testimonies I want to share with you, and some neat ways that you can get hold of the book as well. And if you're a Jewish person listening and you don't agree with me, or you're a seeker, you have questions, or maybe you're a follower of Jesus and you're a little unsettled now because you talked to some rabbis and they're telling you it doesn't really mean this, by all means, give us a call, 866-34-TRUTH, and we will gladly look at what the Scriptures say. And I want to say this as plain as I can. We have nothing to fear. No one is going to come up with some new objection and show us why Jesus cannot be the Jewish Messiah. We'll start in the book of Genesis when we come back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us today on this Thursday, thoroughly Jewish Thursday here on The Line of Fire. Yesterday was Israel's Independence Day celebration. It is a great time of celebration. It is now 64 years that Israel has been recognized as a nation. It's also a time, though, where Israelis think about all the losses, all the people killed in terrorist attacks, the soldiers they've lost as well. So it's a sober day. And I just want to give you a few of those stats, and then we're going to open up the five books of Moses and talk about Messiah in the Torah on this thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Your Jewish-related questions, 866-348-7884. If you want to get into the discussion about Messianic prophecy in the Torah, go to my Facebook page. That's Ask Dr. Brown, Ask Dr. Brown on Facebook. So when Israel became a nation, the population was a fraction of what it is today. Today, it stands at 7.8. 81 million. 75.3% of the population is Jewish and 20.6% is Arab. Oh, you know what that means? There's no ethnic cleansing going on. It means there are more than 1.5 million Arabs. One of them is a member of the Israeli Supreme Court. Others serve in the Knesset. From the day that Israel was established as a nation in 1948 and had its first Knesset, its first parliament, Congress, it had Arab representation, and it continues to. At its establishment, the population of Israel was 806,000. There were people saying there's not enough room for everybody here. And it was much smaller when they were disputing these things in the decades earlier, at the beginning of the 20th century. There's not enough room for everybody. We have Arabs here, a few hundred thousand Arabs, and there's not enough room. Well, there were 806,000 when the state was founded, almost 8 million today. According to numbers published by the Central Bureau of Statistics on Tuesday, Israel's Jewish population stood at 5.931 million people, Arab population 1.623 million, the remaining 4.1%, 327,000 people classified as others. Interesting. So much for the ethnic cleansing stats there. Okay, what about Messiah in the Torah? 866-34-TRUTH. The word Mashiach occurs a number of times in the Hebrew Bible, but it never occurs in an absolutely explicit way that says this is a prophecy of the coming Messiah. Now, I believe there are references to Mashiach, Messiah, in Daniel, the ninth chapter. I believe in Psalm 2, where the king of Israel, established by God, called his son, is the Mashiach, the anointed ruler, ultimately has a messianic application. But generally, when Mashiach is used, it simply means anointed one. So we have Mashiach in the Torah, but it's just about the high priest. In Leviticus 4, Leviticus 6, HaKohen HaMashiach, the anointed priest. That's all it is. So where is the Messiah found in the Torah? And specifically, is Jesus identified as the Messiah in the Torah? Now there are some folks that will start in Genesis 1. And they'll say, according to Genesis 1:1, the beginning God created, that there are hidden references to the Messiah there and to the work of the Spirit and so on. Could be hidden references, could be mystical references, could be, but certainly nothing that's ever quoted in the New Testament, nothing that in any overt way speaks of the Messiah. So to me, it's a matter of reading something into the text. Now, after the fall, there is a curse. There's a curse that's put on the snake. There's a curse that's put on the woman. There's a curse that's put on the man. And remember the order. The snake deceives the woman. The woman brings her husband in. So Eve brings in Adam. They all fall. God says to Adam, what did you do? He says, hey, it was the woman you gave me. Did I ask for a wife? Did I tell you I wouldn't be happy just hanging around with the animals and not having a wife and just, you know, let the animals have their, you know, just hang around with it? Did I tell you I needed a wife? No, the woman you gave me actually puts the accusation back on God, fallen human nature. At work. It's the woman you gave me. And then he says to the woman, God says to the woman, what did you do? And she said, it was the snake. I was just minding my own business. It's the snake. The snake, obviously, that you put in the garden. I mean, everyone shifts blame. So then God curses the snake and the woman and the man and the earth. And then it says in Genesis 3:15, and I'll read from the New Jewish Version, I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and hers. They shall strike at your head, and you shall strike at their heel. Now, if we read it, say, in the ESV, I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. The New Jewish Version just makes this general, something that's going to happen between the offspring of the woman and the offspring of the snake, and there'll be this battle, and they'll strike at your head, and you'll strike at their heels. So the offspring of the snake is going to, you know, try to bite your foot, and human beings will step on it and crush it. So nothing to do with anything spiritual. However, you could say, since the serpent here is more than just a snake, since the serpent here is the epitome of Satan himself, then doesn't that mean this is speaking of the offspring of the woman crushing the head of the snake, the serpent, some final destruction? You could find a deeper spiritual meaning in this, as some church interpreters have through the years, and even some ancient Jewish traditions ultimately associate this with a climax in the days of the Messiah. That's possible. That's possible. I say it's reading a bit into it, but it's possible. You say, well, no, it says her seed. You see, the woman doesn't have the seed. The man has the seed. I'd say that's saying too much. This is not a prophecy of a virgin birth. This is merely speaking of offspring, descendants of the woman. But there will be an ultimate victory, and that's what's spoken of in Romans 16, that the God of peace will soon bruise Satan under your feet. And because of this, early church leaders referred to this as the protoevangelium, the early evangelical announcement, the early gospel announcement, the very first gospel announcement. Let's just say this. I don't think you're going to convince anyone that Jesus must be the Messiah based on this passage. All right? So I accept that it could have messianic overtones, but I would say there is more, much, much more. So let's keep going. Let's keep going beyond the protoevangelium, or the protoevangelium. And let's go to Genesis chapter 22. What's in Genesis chapter 22? The binding of Isaac. And I want to go through this a little further, and then I'll get to your calls, 866-34-TRUTH. The binding of Isaac. In Hebrew, it's called the Akedah, and it's famous in Jewish literature. It speaks of the suffering of Isaac, and according to Jewish tradition, he was 37 years old when this took place. In other words, he was not just a little boy. When you read the text, the impression you get is he's a little boy. Jewish tradition says he's 37 years old. In fact, at the end of his life, or towards the end of his life, he loses his eyesight. And some of the ancient rabbis said, well, that's because the angel appeared there on Mount Moriah. And when the angel appeared, the brightness of the vision hurt his eyes. So that's why later he lost his vision. Again, just interesting Jewish interpretation. But what do we find in Genesis 22? There are a number of points there. We see that Abraham proved his total dedication to God through his sacrificial actions. Genesis 22:12, God says, now that I know you fear God, because you've not withheld from me your son, your only son. In the same way, God demonstrates his love and commitment to us by giving us his own son. But he literally gave us his son. Romans 8:32, he who did not spare his own son but gave him up for us all, how will he not also, along with him, graciously give us all things? And then Isaac is referred to in Genesis 22 as Abraham's only son, his Yahid. In the New Testament, Jesus in his sacrificial death is described as God's only son, his one and only son. A third interesting insight, Isaac's willingness to be sacrificed illustrates the Messiah's obedience even to the point of death. the rabbis made a lot of Isaac's sacrifice, except he didn't actually die and he didn't actually shed his blood, although the rabbis talk about the blood of Isaac and the power of the blood of Isaac through the centuries. Some of the ancient rabbis even say that every sacrifice that was offered in the temple had its power because of the blood of Isaac. The problem is Isaac didn't shed his blood. Messiah did. And then Abraham was confident that even though he was about to sacrifice his son on the mountain, he would somehow return from the mountain with his son. He said to his servants, we'll worship and we'll come back to you. And Hebrews says that there was the confidence that God could even raise him from the dead. Well, that is literally what happened to the Son of God. And interestingly, Abraham tells Isaac, God will provide a lamb. Remember what happened? God provided a ram. What about that lamb? What about that lamb? Back with your calls.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks so much for joining us on the Line of Fire on this thoroughly Jewish Thursday as we look at Messiah in the Torah, messianic prophecy in the Torah, Jesus, Yeshua, spoken of as the Messiah of Israel in the Torah. And taking your Jewish-related questions at 866-348-7884. I want to read a real encouraging review that was just posted on The Real Kosher Jesus. I'm so pleased to hear this, and I want to let you know about some special ways you can get the book today. But first, to the phones, Nick in New York City. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Yes, hi, Dr. Brown.
Hello.
Yes, hello.
Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Sorry. Yes, I have a question about the oral law. I was wondering, is it a hindrance for Jewish people to believe in Jesus while still holding to the oral law? I mean, is that at all possible, or is that something that's just non-negotiable? And is that one of the reasons why they are sort of that they hold back?
All right, it's a very broad question, Nick, but a very important one. First, let me just explain to our listeners what we mean by the oral law. The Jewish tradition says that when God gave the law on Mount Sinai, he gave it in two forms. He gave it in written form, and he gave it in oral form. He gave it in written form, Ten Commandments, and the rest of the five books of Moses that Moses wrote out. And then, while Moses was on Mount Sinai in particular, during those 40 days, God communicated to him what the laws meant, what it meant to work on the Sabbath, details of how to build the tabernacle, things like that, and then gave him principles of interpretation to transmit to future generations. Traditional Jews would say without those explanations, the written law is unintelligible. Then they would say that those traditions were passed on through each generation, and then further traditions were developed as new situations came up and the community leaders made new decisions. And then ultimately, those laws were written down beginning in around 200 AD with first the Mishnah and then a few hundred years after that, the Talmud, and then through the centuries, more and more compilations written down. So the oral law was actually written down over a period of time. But for a traditional Jew, you cannot have the written law without the oral law. For a traditional Jew, you cannot possibly follow the written law without the oral law. And the leaders of the traditional Jewish community, the rabbis, would be looked at as the authority figures who are there to uphold the authority of the oral law and keep the people of Israel walking within those parameters. So it's a whole authority structure along with the traditions and things like that. Now, I have no question, Nick, that there have been oral traditions through the centuries, going back to early times in Israel's history. I would say that those oral traditions were not binding, and I would say that whenever those oral traditions developed in such a way as to get in the way of Scripture, there was a problem. So where did the idea of synagogue come from? Well, that was a Pharisaical development. That was a traditional development. That was not an explicit command within the Torah, the written Torah. However, Jesus went to the synagogue. That was fine. There were other things, though, that he would not do. And he says in Mark 7 to the Jewish leaders, some of the Jewish leaders, you have a fine way of uprooting, of nullifying the word of God through your traditions. So here's what it would come down to, Nick. Everybody has certain traditions. You go to a church service, they meet on a Sunday. They meet at a certain time. The building is structured a certain way. You have a pulpit in a certain place. You have singing. You do this and that. The pastor's wearing a tie. He's not wearing a tie. Everyone has traditions. And traditions in themselves can be good, bad, or neutral. The same way with Jewish believers, some of them love Jewish tradition. Some of them grew up with Jewish tradition and are very drawn to it. Some grew up with tradition and are drawn away from it. We all have our traditions, and the traditions themselves can be fine or they can be neutral. If they get in the way of the lordship of Yeshua, if they get in the way of the life and power of the Spirit, if they get in the way of following the word of God plainly, then those traditions must be cast off, be they Jewish traditions or church traditions or anything else. If a Jewish believer today feels that he or she must be under the authority of the rabbis because they are the keepers, I'm talking about traditional rabbis, that they are the keepers of the oral law, then of course they cannot do that because those traditional rabbis will tell them not to believe in Jesus Yeshua. So in short, if they feel that they must keep the oral law, oral traditions, that's a problem and that's not scriptural. If they keep the traditions and the traditions get in the way of intimacy with the Lord and fruit bearing in the Lord and the life of the Spirit, that's a problem. They need to put those away. If the traditions can be incorporated in a life-giving way in their celebration of the Lord, their following of the Lord, wonderful. Go for it and enjoy and be a blessing to the Jewish community. That's how I would answer your question, Nick.
May I ask a brief follow-up?
Surely.
Thank you. So you wouldn't we wouldn't necessarily be able to identify a specific tradition that would totally render belief in Jesus impossible for a traditional Jew, though, would we?
Except if they interpreted faith in Jesus as being idolatrous.
Right.
Or if they said, well, you have to submit to our authority, and we're telling you he wasn't the Messiah. But outside of that overtly, no. There's nothing, for example, in Sabbath laws. I mean, I would not keep all the Sabbath traditions. I don't feel they're fully in the spirit of Scripture. But you could keep every detailed Sabbath law, and that's not going to get in the way of faith in Yeshua. I would just say there's a greater rest in him you could have. The same way, you know, you could pray most of the prayers, the traditional prayers, and you're not going to have a conflict. The big thing is, though, they're praying for redemption to come as if the first fruits haven't come. And we would say they're already here. By the way, if you go to my website, askdrbrown.org, and then click on Real Messiah and look in the articles, you'll find an article there on the place of rabbinic tradition in Messianic Judaism. So just go to askdrbrown.org, put in the word rabbinic, and you'll find that article. Hey, Nick, got to run, but thanks for a very important question. Can I just read this review to you? This is from Jonathan Amon. He said, Dr. Michael Brown's The Real Kosher Jesus is a dynamic examination of the identity of Jesus with his rich Jewish context. Dr. Brown draws the reader into a progressive revelation of Jesus Yeshua as a Jew, a rabbi, a prophet, a revolutionary, and the long-awaited and soon-returning Messiah. And he says, the progressive revelation of Brown's writing, which manages to both build a case and present a journey, is consistently evangelistic and exceptionally powerful, presenting the beauty of Jesus as the truly Jewish Messiah. And he says this, he says, the real kosher Jesus stands out as an exceptionally relevant and readable work of apologetics and theology. It is a prophetic cry both to the Jewish people and the Christian church to discover the reality of Jesus as he is. It's not only the finest book on the identity of Jesus I've ever read, it's one of the finest books on the gospel I've ever read. And I sent a note to Jonathan just thanking him for a wonderful review. The publisher had sent him a copy to review, and so pleased to see that. You can get exclusively from us the hardcover edition for just $25. We'll pay the postage. So we want to pay the postage to send it to you. Or if you become a torchbearer today, if you become a monthly torchbearer, holding our hands up with a gift of at least $25 or more per month, my thank you gift will be The Real Kosher Jesus in hardcover. Either way, get a copy of the book today. Call us at 1-800-278-9978. That's 1-800-278-9978. Or you can become a torchbearer by going online, askdrbrown.org. Right on the homepage, Jesus, Yeshua, the Messiah of Israel, the Savior of the world.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us today on The Line of Fire. We're asking this question on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Is the Messiah prophesied of in the Torah? That's the most foundational part of the Bible, especially for a Jewish person, but it's foundation for everyone. And God revealed himself to Israel as the God over all creation and as the God of gods at the Exodus when he freed his people Israel from Egypt. That's when he showed that he was the only true God. And then everything that comes after that now must be in harmony with that revelation. Is Messiah spoken of in the Torah? Taking your Jewish-related calls today, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Now, the main messianic prophecy that Jews would point to in the Torah is found in Numbers 24. And Numbers 24 builds on an earlier prophecy. Let's take a look in Genesis chapter 49. Genesis 49, as Jacob is prophesying over his sons before they die, before he dies, excuse me, he says, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until tribute comes to him." Some translate, until Shiloh comes, others until he comes to Shiloh, others until he comes to whom tribute is due. "And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples." This is certainly telling us that the rulership, the leadership, the kingship will come through Judah. Even though Judah wasn't the firstborn, and even though Judah, the man, was not the best behaved, he's not painted as a hero in the Torah. In fact, he's shamed while Joseph is exalted. In two chapters side by side, Genesis 38 and Genesis 39. And yet, by the Spirit, Jacob prophesies that rulership, authority will come to Judah. And it does speak either of one coming to whom tribute will be due. There's debate about that, about the word, the Hebrew word Shiloh, Shiloh. But it's clear, to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. This is not just rulership of Israel, but international rulership. And then building on this, Numbers chapter 24. Numbers chapter 24, which speaks of a royal prophecy. It speaks of a king who will rise. And it's Balak, Balaam, the false prophet, but God gets hold of him and speaks through him. Balaam prophesies this. This is a pagan. Numbers 24:17, "I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. It shall crush the forehead of Moab and break down all the sons of Seth." Some say that's just a prophecy of David. Others say it's just a prophecy of Messiah. Others say it's a prophecy of both. One Jewish tradition says this: "I see him, David, but not now, the Messiah. I behold him, David, but not near, the Messiah." And ultimately, speaking of a messianic ruler who will destroy the enemies of Israel. So is that it? Is that all for messianic prophecy? We looked in the first half hour about Genesis 3:15. Could that be messianic prophecy? Then we look at the Akedah, the binding of Isaac in Genesis 22, and how that prefigures many things having to do with the death and resurrection of the Messiah, God's one and only Son. Okay, prophecy of a king who will rule and reign, crush the enemies of Israel. Yes, we are confident Jesus does that when he returns, but is that it? Is that it for messianic prophecy in the whole Torah? I mean, the Torah is so foundational. That's all it's got to say. Is there nothing more? Oh, no, there is much, much more about the Messiah in the Torah. And that's why Jesus could tell the Jewish people of his day, if you believe Moses, believe me, what was he talking about? We'll look at it when we come back and take your calls right here.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Okay, this is not a professional reviewer. This is not a scholar or professor or a Messianic Jewish leader or Christian leader or something writing this review. Just one I saw on Amazon from a fellow named Wayne reviewing my book, The Real Kosher Jesus. This book could be subtitled, The Best Jewish Tract Ever Written. And here's how he starts. Wowie kazowie. I think that's the first review I've ever had. Wowie kazowie, a five-star review. Any Jewish or non-Jewish person who wants to discover who the real kosher Jesus is needs to prayerfully read this awesome book, not just with an open mind, but with an open heart, all caps, 3 exclamation points. Say it together, wowie kazowie. All right, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Before I go back to my thoughts on Messiah in the Torah, how Jesus Yeshua is spoken of there, is prefigured there, is prophesied of there, I want to go to the phones. Let me just say this. The concept of Messiah is very important in Judaism because ultimately traditional Jews, they're praying for a Messiah to come. They're longing for a Messiah to come. They believe that he will be God's agent to establish peace on earth and universal obedience to the Torah and destruction of Israel's enemies and things like that. When I say universal obedience to Torah, I mean for the Jewish people. So even though the role of Messiah is different within Christianity versus Judaism, the Messiah is very important in Judaism. And yet the traditional Jewish Messiah is really not found a lot in the Torah. Makes you wonder, is there more about the Messiah in the Torah that my Jewish friends, my Jewish colleagues, rabbis are missing? I say absolutely yes. Back to the phones, Eliana in Clinton, Maryland. By the way, Eliana is the name of our oldest grandchild, now 11 years old. So thanks for having a great name.
Thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, my question was, and I guess it's a little bit on a little bit off course of where you're going. I really wanted to get your views regarding it. And the question is, where I'm confused is that I'm definitely convinced that Yeshua is prophesied about in the Old Testament and, you know, in the books of, you know, of the Torah. But where I'm confused is how the Orthodox Christian Church not only say that he's prophesied, but he also shows up there, like, for example, as Melchizedek and you know, and in other ways. And I really wanted to know what your thoughts on that was. I'm really confused by that.
Okay, so the question is, are there not only messianic prophecies or foreshadowings of Yeshua in the Torah, but does he actually appear? So the larger question of divine appearances is called theophanies. People say, I had an epiphany. It's an appearing, it's an event. So a theophany is a divine appearance. And you have numerous theophanies in the Old Testament where God appears, where the prophet sees God, where different people see God, or they see someone called the angel of the Lord, and they associate the angel of the Lord with the Lord to the point they think they're going to die. Or, for example, in Exodus, the 3rd chapter, it says that Moses saw the bush burning, but it wasn't being consumed. He went there to see what's going on, and the angel speaks to him out of the bush. But then as the conversation goes on, he's speaking to the Lord, and Yahweh says to him, take your shoes off from your feet. The place you stand is holy ground. That would be a theophany. In Genesis 32, Jacob wrestles with a man. Hosea 12 tells us he was an angel. But the next day, in the morning, Jacob says, I've seen God face to face. He names the place Peniel, face of God. Was that angel carrying the divine presence in a unique way, or was that angel in some way God himself? And then in Genesis 14, Melchizedek, was he just a foreshadowing of Jesus? Is that what Hebrews 7 is telling us? Or was he actually Jesus appearing in human form? What about Genesis chapter 18? Where Yahweh appears to Abraham, and as you read the text, you see it's Yahweh plus 2 angels. It's the Lord plus 2 angels, and then the 2 angels go on to Sodom, And the Lord, Yahweh, has an extended conversation with Abraham before leaving them. So you have these different divine appearances. How do we explain them? First mystery here, and I take this up in The Real Kosher Jesus. I have a chapter in the secrets part of the book where we reveal secrets and mysteries about the Messiah, the secret of the invisible God who can be seen. We have a problem here because you can't see God and live. And you know that that's reiterated in the New Testament, that, for example, in John 1, it says no one's ever seen God. In John 5, Jesus says you've never seen his form. 1 Timothy 6, it says he dwells in unapproachable light. No one can see him or has seen him. And yet, people did see God. Exodus 24, they saw the God of Israel. So, and it doesn't say, it's not a vision there because they saw him and he didn't strike them. So, I mean, the 74 elders and Moses and others actually see him. So how do we explain these? The Melchizedek account, I just look at, he was a king, he was a human being, he has no genealogy recorded, so he is like Jesus who has no beginning or end. But I just look at him as a regular human being who is a prototype of Jesus because he is a priest king over Jerusalem. All right, I don't look at him as actually Jesus appearing. By the way, according to rabbinic tradition, he was Shem, just for your information, one of the sons of Noah. All right, so let's put that aside. What about the other times where it says in the Torah that people saw God? Exodus 33, God tells Moses, no one can see my face and live. Exodus 24, they saw the God of Israel. I believe, Eliana, that any time in the Hebrew Bible, including the Torah, that people saw God, it was the Son that they saw. No one can see the Father. No one can see the Father in his glory and live. But the role of the Son is to make the Father known. That's why Jesus could say, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. It doesn't mean the physical form. It doesn't mean the body he was in, the tent that he pitched among us. Just like God appeared in the tabernacle, God pitched his tent among the Israelites. So through the person of Jesus, God pitches his tent among us. God, who is complex unity, Father, Son, and Spirit, sits enthroned in heaven. The Father sits enthroned in heaven. By his Spirit, he fills the universe and works among us. And through his Son, he reveals himself to us. The Son is the outshining of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, according to Hebrews 1. So I would have no problem with and in fact, I would absolutely say that in Genesis 18, when Yahweh appears, that Abraham saw the Son of God. That in Exodus 24, at Mount Sinai, right after the Sinai revelation, that is the elders and Moses and Aaron and others went up and saw God, they saw Yeshua, they saw the Son. Is that making sense to you?
I guess where I have difficulty with it and is that, you know, in all those instances, just like you said, it actually says that that they saw an angel, and then they, you know, and then they say God. I always thought that basically the angels, you know, represented him, you know, because it does say an angel in opposed to saying, you know, the Son.
But just hang on. Genesis 18, it said Yahweh appeared. That's all okay. It says. Yahweh appeared, and he looks up and sees three men. And then as it goes on, he has a conversation with one of the men who's identified as Yahweh. Then the other two men leave. And then it says in Genesis 19, and the two angels came to Sodom. What happened to the three men? Well, the other one is Yahweh, who's having an extended conversation with Abraham. So that just says Yahweh appeared. Exodus 24 just says they saw the God of Israel. Doesn't mention angels at all.
Okay.
Now, the other thing is the Hebrew word for angel, malach, just means a messenger. Sometimes right. It can even refer to a human or earthly messenger. So malach, angel, does not mean that it could not be the Lord through his Son. But I didn't even mention any of those angel of the Lord ones in a definitive way. What I mentioned was the ones like Genesis 18 and Exodus 24. And in Exodus 3, say the burning bush, is that an angel bearing the presence of God and representing him? Could be. That's certainly possible. Or on the other hand, is that the Son of God who's appearing as a messenger of the Lord as an angel. Certainly that could be the case as well, just as he appeared among us flesh and blood. But I get into that in a lot of depth in Volume 2 of my series Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus. But a real clear, simple statement I lay out and then give Jewish traditional background as well in The Real Kosher Jesus and the chapter about the secret of the invisible God who can be seen. So that should be of help to you. Hey, got a break, but look at those passages again, especially Genesis 18 and Exodus 24, all right?
All right, thank you.
Sure, God bless you.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, let me take these last few minutes of this hour and summarize what I understand to be the messianic message, messianic prophecy within the Torah beyond what we've talked about. We looked at the potential seeds of messianic prophecy in Genesis 3:15. We've seen the royal prophecies in Genesis 49 and Numbers 24. We've seen the foreshadowing of the sacrificial death of Messiah and his resurrection from the dead and the binding of Isaac in Genesis 22. And we want to look at some other messianic prophecies. We focus today on Messiah in the Torah. Volume 3 of Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus, I talk about this Messiah in the Torah as well. 866-34-TRUTH online, askdrbrown.org. Click on the line of fire. Let me lay out a few other ways where the Messiah is prefigured. Joseph, who is rejected by his brothers, who becomes the savior of the Gentile world, and then the second time around is recognized by his brothers for who he is. There's something very profound. No, I'm not saying that this is direct messianic prophecy. I'm saying it is a foreshadowing. It is a prefiguring. You could say it is a type. In order to be a type, it doesn't mean it has to share all the details exactly. What it means is that one prefigures the other. I think you can make a very valid point about that. Joseph prefigures Jesus, Yeshua, rejected, misunderstood by his Jewish brothers, call them Jewish brothers, Israelite brothers, sons of Israel, then sold into slavery, becomes the savior of the Gentile world, mightily raised up. And then his brothers, the first time, don't recognize him, but the second time, he reveals himself to them, and there is great weeping in the house and great restoration. How about this? Deuteronomy 18. And I have a whole chapter in the secrets section of The Real Kosher Jesus, revealing the mysteries of the hidden Messiah. I have a whole section on the prophet greater than Moses. But Deuteronomy 18, God tells the children of Israel when they come into the land of Canaan that they should not do what the Canaanites do, and all the sorcery and the witchcraft and the consulting the dead and the idols. No, God will give them a prophet to tell them the will of God. And this prophet will be raised up by God and will be like Moses, who will hear what God is saying and declare it to the people. Well, every generation had to have a prophet like that. In other words, Joshua functioned as a prophet like that. And otherwise, the people of Israel would not know what God was saying to them. But Deuteronomy 34, which is meant to sum up everything in Old Testament time, says, and there's still no prophet like Moses who's ever been raised up, who spoke to God face to face and who worked these signs, wonders, and miracles, which made people wonder, well, where is that prophet then? God said he'd give us a prophet like Moses, not just doing what Moses did, but a prophet like Moses. Says it twice, and God had raised him up. And in the exact same language, he was never raised up. Where's that prophet? So by the time you get to the first century, there were Jews who were waiting for the prophet. Where is the prophet? You can even read it in the Gospels. Again, you'll find that all in my chapter in The Real Kosher Jesus book on the prophet greater than Moses. Where's that prophet? Prophet like Moses, this great end-time prophet. They thought he would be a separate figure from the Messiah. No, he's one and the same. And some of the rabbis said the Messiah will actually be greater than Moses. Aha, exactly. not just a prophet like Moses, but even greater. And of course, he prophesies the destruction of the temple. He prophesies how he will fulfill the law and the prophets. And he prophesies the scattering of the Jewish people from Jerusalem, from Israel, until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled, something that we have been watching unfold in this last generation plus. And how about this? How about this? The message of human sinfulness and human failure is found throughout the Torah. I mean, you don't finish the Torah with a state of optimism reading the five books when Moses says, look, this, you rebelled during my life. What are you going to do when I'm dead? What are you going to do when I'm dead? You're going to do even worse. Of course, they did. And he prophesies some of the judgment that's going to come. We see the universal sinfulness of man. We even see in Genesis 8 that the reason God wouldn't destroy the earth with a flood was not because people were getting better, but they were so wicked, God had to keep destroying. He said, all right, I'll never do that again. I'll never destroy the earth with a flood. The good news is God had a system of atonement put in place. And oh, it's overwhelmingly clearly laid out, the importance of blood atonement, chapter after chapter, verse after verse in the Torah. Substitutionary atonement, the innocent taking the place of the guilty, the innocent animal carrying the sins of Israel into the wilderness, the innocent animal being killed on the Day of Atonement, and blood being shed, and that blood bringing atonement. What does it prefigure? Isaiah 53 says it's the servant of the Lord, a human being who will be the asham, the guilt offering, the reparation offering. Messiah fulfills the images, the purpose of the blood sacrifices. That's why there's no more temple and no more blood sacrifices, since he died and rose. And even the atoning power, the death of the high priest in Numbers, the 35th chapter. Wow. I've got a whole section in the Real Kosher Jesus, in the secret section, the last third of the book, where we begin to reveal the mysteries of the hidden Messiah, on the atoning power of the death of the righteous in the Bible and Jewish tradition. One of the most eye-opening things I ever discovered years ago, and as I was learning these things myself, and one of the most eye-opening things we've ever presented. Even the death of the high priest, when he died, his blood would cover the blood of those who were innocently killed, and people could leave the cities of refuge where they had fled as innocent people who accidentally killed someone. An axe head flies off during chopping a tree and someone's killed. Well, that blood pollutes the land, and that person would have to flee for safety to a city of refuge. Otherwise, the family members could come and chase him and take his life. But is he going to stay the rest of his life? No. Numbers 35, till the death of the high priest. When the high priest dies, he gets to go free. Why? Because the high priest, the representative of the people, his death pays even for these sins. Messiah in the Torah, oh, it's rich, it's wonderful. And Jesus said with good reason, if you believe Moses, you would believe me. If you don't yet have a copy of The Real Kosher Jesus, Revealing the Mysteries of the Hidden Messiah, I was mentioning in the first half hour, I've just been so pleased to see the reviews and hearing back from people who are blown away by this book. God moved on me miraculously to write it, laid it on my heart January 19th to start writing. The book was literally published on my desk April 2nd, less than 2.5 months from the day God laid it on my heart to write. We alone have the hardcover edition. You can get paperback on Amazon or your local bookstore. We alone have the hardcover edition. It's only $25 plus postage. Get it today. $25 postage paid. If you already have a copy, get another copy for a Jewish friend or for your pastor, for a colleague. They will be as blessed as you. Get multiple copies. We'll pay the postage on all of them. $25 postage paid. Or if you become a monthly torchbearer and begin to support us on a monthly basis for at least $25 a month and help our worldwide outreach and this radio broadcast, my thank you gift to you this month will be The Real Kosher Jesus. So call right now 1-800-278-9978. That's 1-800-278-9978. And to become a torchbearer, you can call us or go online, askdrbrown.org. My bottom line today, Messiah is absolutely foundational in the Torah, prefigured by Isaac, prefigured by Joseph, prefigured by the sacrifices, prefigured by the death of the high priest, the prophet like Moses, and even greater. We'll answer Jewish objections to Jesus and take your Jewish questions today, right here.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, you're going to like this. In fact, Clay, I want you to go to Amazon.com and look up The Real Kosher Jesus there. You're going to like this, friends. I don't know who in the world came up with this plan. The Real Kosher Jesus, Revealing the Mysteries of the Hidden Messiah, my brand new book, which many of you already have, is on Amazon, and they have a tremendous discount for the paperback. We don't have the hardcover. But check out the price if you want to get it used. The list price for the paperback is $15.99. If you want to get it used, someone is selling a used copy of The Real Kosher Jesus for $999.99. So don't do it. I don't know who did it. Maybe it's a joke. But that's sweet. $999.99. Isn't that wonderful? Michael Brown, thanks for joining us today on this Thursday. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. I have some Jewish questions that I'm going to be answering today. I'm going to walk you through some Jewish objections to Jesus and how we respond. And I'll be taking your calls. 866-34-TRUTH. 866-348-7884 to get on the program. Any Jewish-related question you have, I would be delighted to answer today. AskDrBrown.org, click on the Line of Fire, is our online link to the radio program. Now, I have 5 volumes of books on answering Jewish objections to Jesus. Yeah, 5 volumes, over 1,500 pages. Why? Well, there are a lot of Jewish objections. Some of them are very minor, very simple, very easy to answer. Some of them are more difficult. Some are very difficult and require serious study and serious answers. Now, the good news is everyone has an answer. Good news is there's a good, solid answer to every objection, not twisting things, not trying to make something say something it's not. No, good, simple, solid answers. And I want to say this to every one of you. I want to say this to every one of you, whether you're Jewish or not. I don't know, just demographically, the great majority of you listening are not Jewish, but Jewish or not, if you're a follower of Jesus, if you believe in the scriptures, I want to assure you, as someone who's devoted over 40 years, now saved a little over 40 years, 40 and a half years, I've devoted a lot of time over these 40 years to interacting with people who do not believe. It, or believe differently, I should say. Some are just non-believers, but many believe differently. With religious Jews, rabbis, many, many fine, learned people, men and women I've interacted with. And then people from other faiths. And then people of no faith. And skeptics. And people who are biblical scholars, but are critical. They are liberal. They don't believe in the authority of Scripture. I spent 40-plus years interacting with people like this. And if they weren't asking the hard questions, then I was asking the hard questions. Reading the books of skeptics and non-believers and those who see the biblical text very differently than we do. I want to tell you as plainly as I can, we have nothing to fear in the way of objections. We have nothing to fear. We are on the side of truth. And there is no objection to the authority of Scripture or inspiration of Scripture or messiahship of Jesus that can overturn our faith based on truth. There are solid answers. And sometimes just knowing that there are solid answers is enough to help you when you are getting mentally and emotionally bombarded. We come back. I'm going to tackle some objections to the messiahship of Jesus. Stay with us.
God of light, hear our cry, send the fire. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
You know, I'm looking at some old questions that were handed in that we didn't get to at the Kosher Jesus debate in New York City. We got it to a bunch of them that night, and then I answered some of them on the broadcast after. There may be a few more I'll get to today. But if you've got a Jewish-related question of any kind, Jewish tradition, Jewish Bible interpretation, what Jews believe today, Jews and Jesus, or if you're a Jewish person yourself and you don't believe in Jesus or have questions, today's a great day to call 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. The first hour, I tackled this objection. If Jesus is really the Messiah and he's so important, why doesn't the Torah speak of him at all? And I showed the many different ways that the Torah does point to him and does speak of him. Other Jews have given this fair objection. Nowhere in the Hebrew Bible are we told that we must believe in the Messiah. In other words, a traditional Jew could say to you, look, I'm commanded to obey the law. I'm commanded to love God. I'm commanded to live by these commandments. Where is it? Command me to believe in the Messiah. It's like a different message. Come to the altar and be saved. Pray this prayer and you're in. Say these words and you're in. Where does it say? Where does it tell a Jew to do that? That's like some other religion. That's some Christian evangelist preaching that. Well, actually, that is not true. To say nowhere in the Hebrew Bible are we told that we must believe in the Messiah, that's really a very misleading statement. I mean, first, believing in God and his prophets and his Messiah is basic to the biblical faith. And one of the 13 principles of the faith of traditional Jews is what? I believe in perfect faith in the coming of the Messiah. So according to traditional Judaism, you must believe in his coming. You are required to believe in his coming and to be hoping for and longing for his coming, according to traditional Judaism, the 13 principles of faith of Moses Maimonides, which most traditional Jews look at as foundational and in a summary way, laying out the foundations of the Jewish faith. You say, well, no, that's just we believe he will come. Oh, okay, well, when he comes, do you stop believing? When he comes, do you reject him? When he comes, do you not say he's the one? We believe in him. We recognize him. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about recognizing who Jesus Yeshua is. We're talking about recognizing who the Messiah is. And when you recognize him, you put your trust and faith in him as the Messiah, and you follow him, as I would expect traditional Jews want to do in the future. Here, think of it like this. Many of you know what happened in Brooklyn over a decade ago, or over two decades ago. There was a growing movement among ultra-Orthodox Jews from one particular Hasidic sect, one particular Jewish sect called the Lubavitchers. That's based on the city they came from in Russia previously. So Lubavitcher, just based on that city, the Lubavitcher Hasidim. Just think of them as ultra-religious Jews, very, very devoted. And they believe that their leader, Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the grand rabbi, they called him the Rebbe, they believed, many of them, believed that he was the Messiah and that he was going to reveal himself, and they began to sing songs, Long Live King Messiah. Now, the last 2 years of his life, he suffered from a debilitating stroke, and he was unable to speak and could barely communicate, just could wave his hand periodically, and that would stir up the multitudes as they would be gathered in a synagogue, maybe 1,500 or 2,000 packed in there and singing, Long Live King Messiah. Others were saying, well, he had no way to stop them from singing. He was mute. He was paralyzed by the stroke. The fact of the matter is there was a strong movement. You can go to Israel today and still see these billboards, Welcome King Messiah. You can go to the 770 Eastern Parkway in Brooklyn, and you'll still see the big signs, Welcome King Messiah, and the vans that go out celebrating him as King Messiah. Now, throughout the movement that has died down, and most will not openly say, or most do not actually believe, that he is the Messiah. He died in 1994 at the age of 92. But as this movement grew, and to this day, those that hold to it, they want people to believe in him as the Messiah. And let's just say a traditional Jewish viewpoint, all right? You're praying every day, Ani ma'amin be'emunah shlema b'biyat HaMashiach. I believe, perfect faith in the coming of Messiah, and even though he tarried, I'll wait for him every day, believing that he'll come. That would be one of the things that's recited daily by a traditional Jew, along with prayers for the coming of the Messiah. So now, let's just say traditional Jewish viewpoint here. A man begins to arise, a great teacher in Israel, maybe 60, 70 years old, and wow, suddenly he's captivating Jews around the world, and hundreds of thousands of Jews are becoming religious Jews, and now millions of Jews are becoming religious Jews, and they're now just flocking back to the land of Israel. Like, could this guy be the Messiah? This is the way it would go in traditional Jewish thought. And then he begins to fight the wars of the Lord and destroy the enemies of Israel. Wow, maybe he is the Messiah. And then he finishes regathering the exiles, and then he rebuilds the temple and then establishes peace on the earth. He's the Messiah. So there is this process of could he be, looking, waiting, and then yes, he is. Well, that's what we're telling Jewish people to do with Jesus, Yeshua. Look at the prophecies that had to be fulfilled before the second temple was destroyed. Look at how he had to die and rise before the second temple was destroyed. Look at how he had to die and rise before the second temple was destroyed and then be rejected by many of his people and then become a light to the ends of the earth. And then, after becoming a light to the ends of the earth, his own people recognizing him. And then he returns in the clouds. First came on a donkey, then he comes on the clouds to establish his kingdom in Israel and all over the earth. And let's remember that the people of Israel were commanded to believe in his prophets, to believe in the prophets of Israel, and they would succeed. 2 Chronicles 20:20, believe in the Lord your God and you will be upheld. Believe in his prophets and you will be successful. So this idea that nowhere does the Hebrew Bible tell us we're to believe in the Messiah. No, to the contrary, this is even in harmony with Jewish thought, if you can understand it rightly, that we are to recognize who the Messiah is and put our trust in him as Messiah in order to be faithful to God. Oh, one more point. How does Isaiah 53:1 start after the announcement in the previous three verses at the end of Isaiah 52, where it talks about this one who will be high and lifted up, more than, according to Jewish tradition, greater than Abraham, Moses, and even the angels, first terribly disfigured, highly exalted. Kings will shut their mouths. They can't believe what they've heard. Who is this? How does it start in chapter 53, verse 1? What's it say? Who has believed our report? And to whom is the arm of the Lord revealed? That's our message to the Jewish community. Who has believed our report? What about Isaiah 53? Through the week, we've been telling you about a new video, a new DVD, Day of Discovery, 2.5 hours of amazing video footage. The Day of Discovery broadcast put together with four different biblical scholars. I was part of this. Just a wonderful presentation, Isaiah 53. We say it's the clearest messianic prophecy in all of Scripture. Well, there are lots of Jewish objections to it. No. You mentioned Isaiah 53, but it really can't refer to Jesus. So I want to answer some of those for you today, all right? 866-34-TRUTH. Any Jewish-related question you have, we'll be taking your calls. How about this? If you want to know what Isaiah 53 is talking about, this is a Jewish objection, just read Isaiah 52 and Isaiah 54. The context is the return of the Jewish people from Babylonian exile 550 years before Jesus. In other words, it has nothing to do with Jesus. It's just a prophecy of the Jews coming out of exile. Ah, good observation, but not totally right by any stretch of the imagination. What do I mean? Here are the facts that when the Jewish people were in exile and the prophets began to speak about being delivered from exile, delivered from their suffering, and they would come back to Jerusalem, The prophets, against that backdrop, began to prophesy of something even more that would happen. Not only will they be delivered from exile, not only will they return to Jerusalem, but the messianic era will begin. The messianic era will unfold. The backdrop to the prophecies of the Messiah is the return from the Babylonian exile. And the one who brings those prophecies to fulfillment is none other than Jesus, Yeshua, as we will see. Whole lot to talk about. Oh, I want to share some neat responses to the real kosher Jesus also. Back with more.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us today on the Line of Fire. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Discussing some Jewish objections to Jesus being the Messiah, answering your Jewish-related questions, and focusing for a few minutes on Isaiah 53. So another objection that Isaiah 53 cannot refer to Jesus is that Isaiah 53 speaks of the people of Israel, not Jesus, or any Messiah. Now, the servant of the Lord, the term the servant of the Lord, occurs almost 20 times, beginning Isaiah 41 up through Isaiah 53. And sometimes it clearly refers to the nation of Israel as a whole. But you know, often when it does, it speaks of the nation of Israel as dumb and deaf and blind, disobedient. It's not the most wonderful picture that's painted. It's Israel in exile, suffering for its sins. And then it speaks of the servant of the Lord sometimes as an individual. In Isaiah 49, the servant of the Lord is an individual, identified as Israel, just like there was a man named Israel, Jacob Israel, identified as Israel, fulfilling the destiny and purpose of Israel, but yet it's an individual. And this individual's mission, part of the individual's mission, is to do what? To restore the tribes of Israel. This can't be Israel itself. It's an individual. And you'll see when you get into the 50th chapter, it's an individual. And when you go through Isaiah 53, the most natural, obvious meaning is it's an individual. Let me explain it like this. This one individual Israelite fulfills the mission. It's almost like you send out army troops and 100 men go into a very, very difficult area. It's a difficult mission, and everybody gets picked off along the way, but one guy survives and carries out the mission. Well, that's the mission of America. That's the mission of those troops. Jesus, Yeshua, is the one who carries out and fulfills successfully the mission of Israel, which is what? To make God known to the ends of the earth. Oh, yeah, that's why Jewish people are here. The high calling on the Jewish people to make God known, not just to keep the Torah and for people to look at them keeping the Torah, but to declare his praises to the ends of the earth. And Isaiah 53 speaks of an innocent righteous sufferer who makes others righteous and yet is suffering terribly. If it was the nation of Israel as a whole, they would not be suffering terribly if they were so righteous, because God says, if you're righteous, I'll bless you. If you're unrighteous, I'll curse you. You say, well, could it be the remnant of the nation, the righteous remnant? Yeah, righteous remnant of one, the only one whose death has produced healing and salvation and transformation, the only one who not only died but rose, as in Isaiah 53. Oh, yeah, there are lots of objections, but there are solid answers to every single one. You look at the objections like this, like a good objection is like a good pitch. You get a good batter up there, and that batter, using the force of that pitch, hits the ball even further, going out. Yesterday afternoon, 6 in the evening, went to be there with my grandson, Andrew. He was there with his mom, our daughter, but our son-in-law had to be over at church doing some ministry. So I was there, actually got to be the bat boy, a little bit large, old bat boy, just would run out after the hitter hit and grab the bat and bring it back. Yeah, I was running. Oh, yeah. But when the game was over, Andrew said, "Grandpa, can we practice for a while?" It was just the two of us. I didn't have a glove. I mean, it's hardball, but you can handle that. It's all right. He's eight. He's got quite an arm. He said, "How about you pitch? I'll hit." Well, when he hits, I got to go run all through the field and get the ball. It's part of the game. He hits it, goes way into the outfield. I got to run into the outfield and get the ball and then try to throw it home before he gets home. Otherwise, he gets a home run. Okay, enough of this. He goes, "Well, I want to pitch to you." I said, "All right, well, you got to get the ball. If you pitch to me, you got to get the ball." He said, "Okay." And he was getting some of the others. But he pitched the ball in, and I hit the ball back out. The only problem is I clubbed it a few times. I'm a big guy, and I clubbed the ball a few times. You know, using a little bat, relative clubbing the ball. I mean, like big league clubbing the ball. Probably would have had a pop up to second base, my best shot. But anyway, well, when I clubbed the ball, it didn't help because now I had to run the bases and he was going to try to chase it and throw me out. But all that to say, sorry for the fact, gave me an opportunity to talk about my grandson. All that to say that a good objection is like a good pitch. And a good batter is going to take that pitch and the force of that and hit it further out. So all the objections that come my way about Jesus being the Messiah, that come your way, good, solid objections, have better, solid, biblical answers. And as good as the objection is, the answer is all the more solid, in that sense, to knock it out of the park with biblically-based truth. 866-34-TRUTH. Karen in Denver, Colorado, thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Yes, I don't know if you can help me, but I don't know if it's kind of related to a Jewish topic, but anyway, I'll tell you. My husband was from northern Spain, and he passed away, and before he passed away, he was telling me that his grandmother was Jewish, and her last name was like Zazu, and I was telling my daughter, and my daughter is a born-again Christian, and I was telling my daughter, so she got all excited, and so she tried to look up some records, and there was a fire in that place where they kept all the records in northern Spain, and so there's no records, and she has no way of looking back into the ancestry. But she was wondering, how can she find out if she has any Jewish blood?
Yeah, it's not that easily done, and there's a lot of bogus stuff that's out there. What I would recommend is that you go to a local synagogue, especially if you have an Orthodox synagogue, not a Messianic congregation, but to only because they won't have the same records or data to be able to help. But go to an Orthodox synagogue and say you're trying to trace this out to see if there is Jewish blood. There can be some ways to do it on internet where you can check the names and things and sometimes have some data. So, I mean, it's worth giving it a shot to type in the information and to say, you know, Jewish genealogy, and to put in the names, and you may get some data if this is something well-known. But otherwise, if you can go to a local synagogue, sometimes they'll be able to connect you with records much more because people will come to the synagogue and say, "Hey, I'm trying to find out if there is Jewish blood." So that's really the best.
But they won't recognize it. She has one cousin over there.
That's okay. It doesn't mean recognize, just for her own knowledge, for her own information.
And they won't give her any information.
They won't.
So that's the only source she has, but she did look on the internet, and she found that the name is that name did come up in that city where he's from. But
it's a little tough. Look, I don't even know what my name Brown was shortened from. We're not even sure of that. But hey, Karen, internet, local synagogue, those are the best choices I know. Sorry.
Well, would they let her look at the records being the
I don't know. They're not necessarily going to have extensive records there. They would just know how to.
Oh.
How to access and look into it. It's not like they have all kinds of archives. But hey, I'm out of time, Karen. Gotta run. We come back, I want to tell you about a special way to get hold of the real kosher Jesus.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown.
your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us today on the Line of Fire broadcast, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. I almost said you've got questions, we've got answers. We do that on Fridays on the Line of Fire. But today, if you've got Jewish-related questions, Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, we devote time to that. First hour, took some calls, but devoted most of the time to talking about the Messiah in the Torah, Jesus, the Messiah in the Torah. And then we've talked about some Jewish objections to the Messiahship of Jesus in the first half hour. Talked about Jews saying, well, nowhere are we commanded to believe in the Messiah, and Isaiah 53 can't refer to the Messiah. We've looked at some of those objections, taking your calls, 866-34-TRUTH. But I want to go to the phones quickly today, and also want to let you know about something special we're doing with the Real Kosher Jesus. I read a review that was posted that was really got my attention. It was posted on Amazon, but the fellow posting it also has a blog. And he said, the Real Kosher Jesus stands out as an exceptionally relevant and readable work of apologetics and theology. It is a prophetic cry to the Jewish people and the Christian church to discover the reality of Jesus as he is, as he revealed himself to the world. It is not only the finest book on the identity of Jesus I've ever read, it is one of the finest books on the gospel I've ever read. It has transformed my view of the revelation of God's love and redemption in Jesus, Yeshua. And I like the way he ends it. Many thanks to Charisma House for providing this complimentary review copy. I was not required to give a positive review. I've given an honest review, and I let him know how humbled I was to hear how the book impacted him and how he described it. So I want to tell you in a moment about some special ways that you can get hold of the Real Kosher Jesus. But I want to go straight to the phones. Bob in Alpharetta, Georgia, thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown, how are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
I have a question. I was driving home from work, and it came to me to say, okay, we talk about the Jewish people as a whole. Who in their Jewish culture will determine who the Messiah is?
Right. So it's a fair question. Let's think of this. Number one, in the Jewish world, Reform Jews are the most liberal. You have the three main branches with then lots of sub-branches and things slightly outside of these three. But you have the three major branches, which are Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform. And Conservative is much closer to Reform than it is to Orthodox. Reform Jews don't even believe in the coming of a Messiah. They believe in a Messianic age, but that will be primarily through human improvement, human self-development. So they don't even believe in the coming of a Messiah. Conservatives do, but not really zealously. It's only the Orthodox, and then the very Orthodox, who are super zealous, waiting for the coming of the Messiah. But what they would claim would be, and this is the traditional Jewish scenario that I mentioned in the first half hour, what they would say is that it will become self-evident over a period of time. In other words, that you've got this Jewish figure who's turning Jews, kind of like Jewish revival, right?
Mm-hmm.
That Jews are turning back to Torah and turning back to rabbinic tradition, and wow, something. Who is this guy? He's amazing. What a teacher. And then there's several things he would do, you know, regathering the exiles, and boy, they're just pouring back into the land, or he's doing it, calling them back, and supernatural things are happening. And then fighting the wars of the Lord, which could be literal wars. You know, maybe he's raised up in Israel and Iran attacks or these others attack, and they're defeated under his leadership. It's like, wow, he really could be the guy. And then he rebuilds the temple, and then he establishes peace on the earth. They'd say he's the guy. It's self-evident. So there'd be a process of first, he's the presumptive one. He does X, Y, Z. He's the presumptive one. Then when he does the rest, he must be. The problem is there are many other messianic prophecies in terms of the atoning death of Messiah and other things that he won't do. So what about those? What about those? But Bob, thanks for the call.
Fire we want, for fire we please.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Taking your Jewish-related questions today on the Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Online, askdrbrown.org. Click on the Line of Fire. Back to the phones on this thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Joshua in St. Augustine, Florida, thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. Dr. Brown, the dual Messiah here, Mashiach ben Ephraim or ben Yosef, the suffering Messiah, and Mashiach ben David, the ruling Messiah, when do you believe in your studies that that started? And was it a Yemenite tradition? Was it a Sephardic tradition or something else? Thank you.
All right, sure thing. Thanks for the question, Joshua. There are actually two different dual Messiah theories that we have in Judaism, all right? Two different dual Messiahs. On the one hand, we have reflected in the Dead Sea Scrolls. By the way, in my book, The Real Kosher Jesus, Revealing the Mysteries of the Hidden Messiah, I have a special section in it. The last third of the book is the hidden Messiah of Israel, where I reveal secrets of biblical truth that most people have been unfamiliar with. And I talk about the secret of the suffering Messiah and the secret of the priestly Messiah. So, Joshua, first part of your question, there are different traditions about two Messiahs in Judaism. One goes back to the times before Jesus. We have it reflected in the Dead Sea Scrolls, Mishichei Aharon v'Yisrael, the Messiahs, plural, of Aaron and Israel, that there would be a priestly Messiah and a royal Messiah. What does that go back to? That goes back to the Bible. That goes back to the importance of the high priest in Israel along with the king. They were both Mashiachs, anointed of the Lord. It goes back to to David being a prototype of the Messiah, and of David it is said that the Messiah said, "You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek," who himself was a priest king. So the idea in Zechariah, the sixth chapter, the priest representing the Messiah, the branch, sits on a throne wearing a crown. It's really quite remarkable. So this goes back to Scripture. It's also reflected not only in the Dead Sea Scrolls, but in what's called the Testament, the Testaments of the 12 Patriarchs. Some of this dates to after the time of Jesus, some before, but it speaks there of a messianic figure from the tribe of Levi and a messianic figure from the tribe of Judah. You asked the question about the later rabbinic tradition, because these that we have in the Dead Sea Scrolls, that's been pretty much forgotten by Judaism. Traditional Judaism, including the Talmud, on one occasion and then often thereafter, speaks of another Messiah, not just the Messiah son of David, but the Messiah son of Joseph or Ephraim. Where does that tradition come from? It seems to come from a time after the time of the New Testament, and some even believe it arises in the second century when Simeon Bar Kokhba, who was a Jewish general who led the revolt against Rome in 132 to 135 and was very successful before ultimately being destroyed in horrific bloodshed and suffering for the Jewish people, that some believe that there was such hope in this Messiah, and then he dies and he suffers, that helped birth this idea of a Messiah, the son of Joseph, who would fight in the last great war of the Lord and be defeated and then raised from the dead by the Messiah, son of David, who would then take it from there, you could say. Others believe, Joshua, that this just reflects the suffering of the people of Israel and that this was a way of projecting their sufferings and having someone they could identify with, hence a suffering Messiah, not just a royal Messiah. And those traditions are found in the Talmud about a suffering Messiah, pictured as a leprous man by the gates of Rome. And he takes off his bandages. Instead of changing them all at once, he takes them off to change them one at a time, just in case it would be time for him to be revealed as Messiah. So these traditions go back into the heart of the Jewish people as far as our suffering, as far as our corporate pain. And we recognize the Messiah must be one like us. And then passages like Isaiah 53 are used to point in this direction as well, to say that the Messiah will suffer. And that's also very ancient in Judaism. The question is, why Messiah, son of Joseph, Ephraim, and we really cannot pinpoint that for sure. We can understand the concept of a suffering Messiah, but we really can't pinpoint why Messiah, son of Joseph, Messiah, son of Ephraim. But it does go back to fairly ancient times, probably within a few hundred years of the New Testament, maybe even earlier. But thank you, sir, for the call. I'll give you all the information I can without speculating where we're not sure. If you don't yet have a copy of The Real Kosher Jesus, which I joyfully hold in my hands, Revealing the Mysteries of the Hidden Messiah, we alone have the hardcover. You can get the paperback in your local Christian bookstore, Amazon.com, online. You can order it. But we alone have the hardcover, which is a beautiful edition, makes a great gift, makes a great study tool for you. The most eye-opening book you may read in years on who Jesus is and Jewish roots and Jewish background. And the best tool you can give that I've ever produced to a Jewish person who wants to find out more about Jesus. It's only $25 postage paid, but if you order today, we'll pay the postage on the book. Or if you become a monthly supporter, become a monthly torchbearer, and stand with us in this radio outreach and with our workers bearing fruit for Jesus around the world and our efforts to reach the lost sheep of the house of Israel here in America and around the world, if you stand with us with your monthly gift of $25 or more and join our growing army of torchbearers, I will send you as a special thank you gift a hardcover volume of The Real Kosher Jesus. Either way, take advantage of this special offer today. Give us a call at 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978. Or you can become a torchbearer by going online to askdrbrown.org. It's right there on the home page. All right. Vic in Denver, Colorado, thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown.
Hello.
My very favorite musical is Fiddler on the Roof.
Uh-huh.
I have a couple of questions with regard to that. At the Sabbath scene, Tevye's wife lights the Sabbath candles, I presume, and then she kind of fans the flame kind of towards her face.
Yeah.
And my next question is with regard to the wedding. At the end of it, they put a glass on the floor, and then they crush it with their feet. I just wondered what the significance of those two things are.
Yeah, those are great questions. The fact is there's a little bit more speculation about where the tradition comes from, women who are waving their hands. And here I'll give you the answer that's on an Orthodox Jewish website. But so people understand this. It's the role of the woman in Jewish tradition on the Sabbath to light the Sabbath candles. And the reason you'd light Sabbath candles was also because you'd have no light after that. And according to Exodus, you couldn't light a light, use fire, light a light on the Sabbath. Obviously, you have to use fire to light a lamp or a candle in the ancient world. So you'd be lighting the candles, and those candles would give you light through the night of the Sabbath. So the woman covers her eyes as she does this. And also has to do with seeing the light when she's lighting the candles, all these intricate little Jewish laws, and she pronounces a blessing. And then she motions with her hands like she's waving something towards her and then pronounces the blessings. So women traditionally wave their hands three times in front of the candles, semicircular, inward-leaning hand motions. The hand waving is a symbolic greeting for the Shabbat queen, the Sabbath queen, ushering her holy presence into the home. After the third wave, the hands end up over the eyes, and the woman recites the blessings on the candles. I've heard other explanations, but this is a common one. You know, she's ushering the holy presence of the Sabbath into the home, and hence the inward motion of the hand waving. As far as the glass, that's a more certain answer, which is this: the glass is wrapped in a napkin or something so that it's not going to scatter. And then the groom will stamp on it with his foot and crush it, and then everyone, yay, and celebrates and all this. Well, it's followed by celebration, but it's done so that Jewish suffering is remembered. It's done to remember that even in the midst of the joy of the celebration of a wedding, that the temple is still destroyed, that there's still Jewish suffering. So it is a way to remember suffering in the midst of a time of celebration of the Jewish people. And that's why that custom is performed. Now, you wouldn't know it because of the joyful shout after it. But the joyful shout is to say we remember the suffering and now we go to celebrate.
Very interesting. By chance, does he do it with his right foot or does it matter?
I assume the right foot. That's what's in my head. Hey, everything matters in Judaism. There's always a specific law as to how you do it. But I've got like a minute break. I will check that for you in a minute, just in case I miss something. No one's ever asked me that question. So, all right, thanks for the call, man.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I want to read something to you about the suffering Messiah. And I don't remember ever seeing the foot stomping with a foot other than the right foot, but I never watched it. Never watched it. So what foot stomping? Well, it's reference to the last caller about the breaking of the glass. So what breaking of the glass? Well, the breaking of the glass of the Jewish one. What breaking of glass of the Jewish? Well, see, you missed the call. But did you see Fiddler on the Roof? Did you see Fiddler on the Roof? But yeah, it is a Jewish tradition, and you'll have it at every traditional wedding or even nearly traditional wedding, that after the ceremony, you know, and the pronouncing of the seven blessings and things like this over the couple, that there's a glass that's wrapped in a napkin. So say, an actual cloth napkin, type you put on your lap at a nice restaurant, you know, wrapped in that so that the glass doesn't scatter. And then the groom stomps on it and smashed to remember the destruction of the temple and Jewish suffering in the midst of the celebration. 866-34-TRUTH with your Jewish-related questions on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Let me read something to you that is in my book, The Real Kosher Jesus. The last third of the book is, called The Hidden Messiah of Israel, where I talk about the secret of the invisible God who can be seen, and the secret of the suffering Messiah, and the secret of the atoning power of the death of the righteous, and the secret of the priestly Messiah, and the secret of the prophet greater than Moses, and the secret of the 6,000 years, and the secret of the hidden wisdom. Ooh, interesting. So, secret of the suffering Messiah, I quote world-renowned Jewish anthropologist scholar, the late Raphael Patai, and listen to what he says. Patai says the sufferings Israel must face in the days of the Messiah are temporary and transitory. They will last, according to the Talmudic view, 7 years. Later tradition reduces this period to mere 45 days. The Messiah himself, on the other hand, must spend his entire life, from the moment of his creation until the time of his advent, many centuries, even millennia later, in a state of constant and acute suffering. Well, the question is, where does this tradition of Jewish suffering come from? And this is what Patai says. There can be little, we're talking about in Jewish tradition, the idea of a suffering Messiah. There can be little doubt that psychologically the suffering Messiah is but a projection and personification of suffering Israel. Similarly, the leper Messiah and the beggar Messiah spoken of in the Talmud are but variants on the theme of suffering Israel, personified in the suffering Messiah figure. And it is undoubtedly true in the psychological sense that, as the Zohar states, the acceptance of Israel's sufferings by the Messiah, read their projection onto the Messiah, eases that suffering which otherwise could not be endured. My Jewish friends, this is telling us that we need a Messiah who suffers on our behalf. We need a Messiah who suffers alongside of us, that we can identify with, who comes into our world in the midst of our suffering and gives us hope, redemption, freedom, healing, restoration, and forgiveness. Messiah is one of us. All right, time for one last call. Danielle in Cleveland, Ohio. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
I'll be brief. I'll get right to the point.
Sure.
Star of David, the Seal of Solomon. I'm a Messianic Jew. And it is forbidden in the Torah to make an image of anything in the heavens, on the earth, or under the sea. And I've noticed that this is a recurrent tradition. And from my research, it's condemned in the book of Amos, specifically in Amos chapter 4, verse 2, and in the book of Acts, where Stephen is stoned.
Mm-hmm.
He mentions it. And I wondered if you could draw a little light on this tradition and whether it is biblical, and or is it idolatry? And if so,
right. The stars that are being spoken of back then, or Amos, that's nothing to do with Star of David. But the question is, what is the origin of the Star of David? It's certainly not idolatrous. In other words, it's not a representation of God. It's not to be worshipped. It's not associated with God. It's associated as a sign of the Jewish people. But does it have certain occultic background? There's
that's
no question.
Another point I wanted to bring
right,
out.
Right, right. So there's no question that this is a symbol that has been used in numerous different ways. It has been used in the occult, and it has been used as a symbol of the Jewish people. In other words, there are some symbols that have become popular for certain reasons. When I went to India the first time, I was shocked to see the swastika everywhere. And I thought, I can't. India! Terribly anti-Semitic. No. It's a Hindu sign. The swastika is a Hindu sign for luck or good fortune. And the Nazis took it over and used it as the symbol of the Nazi party. Within Hinduism, it's just a symbol for good luck, good fortune. So some symbols get taken over and changed. And basically, the Star of David was a symbol that was used for many, many centuries as a symbol to represent the Jewish people. And it was used for many, many centuries in various occultic ways. But you cannot say decisively that it was borrowed from the occult to be used as a symbol of the Jewish people. Best
but there
I
had to be a point of introduction into Jewish worship.
Yeah, but exactly. But it's not part of Jewish worship. That's the whole thing. It has nothing to do with worship. It has nothing to do with worship or idolatry. It simply has
when
to...
When I walk into a synagogue and it's sitting in a central place...
But it's got nothing to do with worship. All it is saying we're Jewish. And in other words, it's not like the cross, which speaks of Jesus.
Is there a specific commandment that says you must make an image of a six-pointed star?
No, but there's nothing against it, though. In other words, it's just a symbol of the Jewish people. Look, I've been in churches that have an American flag. It has nothing to do with worship. But hey, listen, Danielle.
I've been in them, too, and I have the same feelings about that.
I've got no argument with it. Hey, I'm not out to defend it. That's not the issue. I'm not out to defend the Star of David. I'm simply answering the questions. And if you're personally offended by it, then by all means, don't have it as a symbol in your home.
I'm afraid because I see it as
But it's got nothing to do with idolatry, though. Yeah, I've got to run, though.
Block.
Yeah, I've just got to run because I'm out of time. But thank you for the call. Always nice to hear from our friends in Cleveland. All right, we're out of time. But remember, The Real Kosher Jesus, the hardcover, we alone have the hardcover edition. The reviews coming in are heartwarming. It'd be above and beyond what I was expecting to hear. I'm so blessed and encouraged by the responses we're getting to the book. Eye-opening read for every follower of Jesus. Eye-opening. And phenomenal tool to give to a Jewish friend, coworker who does not yet know Jesus. We alone have the hardcover. That is our ministry exclusive edition. $25, and we'll pay the postage. So call 1-800-278-9978 to order your copies. You can get multiple copies, 1-800-278-9978. Or if you'd like to become a monthly supporter, join our growing army of torchbearers, and you've been thinking of doing it, dive in this month, because my gift to you is you become a monthly supporter, at least $25 or more, supporting our ministry. I'll send you a copy of The Real Kosher Jesus as my thank you, as a free gift, hardcover. We'll pay the postage. Go online to become a torchbearer. Ask drbrown.org or call 1-800-278-9978. My bottom line today, strong objections to the faith are like a good fastball by a good pitcher. But when the hitter hits that ball, it goes even further. Yes, there are objections, but we have much, much more solid answers.